He does not know how to respond.
You've known her for a long time?
Aye. We were raised together in this house for some number of years. Of course, she was not called Belle then. Her name is Harriet, and she's quite flat-chested.
There is a pair of closed double doors on the landing, from where the sounds of a party emanate. There is a string quartet, laughter, the clinking of glasses. Another Negro, as cool and statuesque as the first, swings these doors open and ushers them within with a pair of spotless kid gloves.
This is a new kind of intimidation, Mr. Hancock thinks.
No lantern-jawed bullies to keep the clients in their place, only handsome blackamoors to strike them into apologetic silence. Angelica rattles on.
Oh, she's ever talked this way. Indentured servitude and legal prostitution and la la la. One wonders how she got to be where she is, for she's not so very beautiful.
Inflecting this last phrase as a question, she looks back at him over her shoulder with her wide, clear eyes. Her powdered cheek is apricot soft, but his tongue is fat in his mouth, his mind too slow. He cannot say the words he wishes he could, and which she is waiting for.
Not as beautiful as you.
Whenever Mr. Hancock feels overpowered by his situation, he turns his mercantile eye upon it. And so, on entering Mrs. Chapel's great salon, he does not note the shards of rainbow-tipped light that bounce across the walls, but the rock-crystal pendants of the chandelier that scattered them. And he does not see the bare throats and bosoms of the girls, but rather the gauzy muslin they are swathed in. He sees barley-sugar glass sconces and says to himself, Murano. He sees the pretty pink and green painted porcelain vases and thinks, Beau. The fine silk upholstery? He sniffs, French, without question. Smuggled. Now is that not the measure of the woman? In his mind he strips the place down into its many precious parts, the swagged silk at the windows, the decanters of sack and port and shrub, the leopard-spotted heartwood tables, names them carefully and prices them up, as if by understanding the machinery he might also understand its effect. He marks the people, of course, but both sexes are a bafflement to him. They are not his sort. Although, perhaps I must now try to be theirs, he thinks to himself. Each of the women is dazzlingly turned out in fashions quite new to him, and he endeavours to commit to memory the particular ways they dress their hair and wear their gowns, so that he might describe it to Suki later. She is always hungry to know the fashions of the city, but he has no eye for them.
No, but what kind of train? She demands. Or, and you did not note whether she carried a fan?
And so he finds he has let her down once more.
Mark that, says Angelica. Parliament is in session here, if not yet in the house.
He looks, and yes, indeed, these men now filing in are all great men. Their faces so well known to him that it feels as if he has stepped through flat paper into a moving version of the pamphlets passed around his coffee-house. He has furthermore seen some of them in person on occasion, when business sends him to the westerly end of Oxford Street, or the fine leafy squares to its north, and sometimes in the reeking, bellowing crowd at cockfights or exhibitions. But they are of a different water. He knows that, not to be touched or spoken to, however close they pass him by.
Are they all... Are they here for me?
He asks weakly.
For my mermaid?
Aye, she says. It's the talk of the town.
All their important doings, he says, and they set them by to come here?
To see your mermaid.
He cannot credit it.
Members of Parliament, titled men with the most sharpened intellect and loftiest ambition, have been drawn to something he, Mr. Hancock, brought before them.
"I had never expected such a thing," he says, and she squeezes his hand as if he were a little child brought as a treat to the menagerie.
"You may expect this sort of thing now," she says.
All this being said, to him they do not appear splendid. Their blue and buff costumes are too much of a muchness for him to tell one from another, although some of them are young and tall, and others bent old men or corpulent in their middle age. Furthermore, they are neither clean nor tidy. They look as if they have not slept at all, and from their stained shirts and unfurled stocks comes the acrid smell of bodies so soused in liquor that it now emanates from their pores. He rasps his hand across his jaw. It is smoother, probably, than some of theirs, which straggle with 3 days' growth or more. They mark him as he moves amongst them. He feels the twitching of their small eyes, but they cannot make sense of him. Is he a tradesman come tumbling in at the wrong door? A persistent drunk yearning after one of the acolytes of Venus? Or indeed an angry father come to haul his daughter back to niceness? They cannot guess. They will not approach him. And they turn back into their conversations.
"Did you imagine," one drawls, "that such a thing would come of it?"
"How could I have?" replies his friend. "I never titched the girl before."
Of course, if Mr. Hancock finds their speech peculiar, it is only for his own lack of cultivation. If he cannot recognize their baby talk and garbled vowels as the signalers of good breeding that they are, the loss is all his. Since he has spent 20 years outside the society of genteel Whigs, he must be forgiven for hearing their speech as a cacophony of pantomime sneezes. They pronounce the first syllable with great energy and trail off into a drawl as if between a word's first letter and its last they have lost all conviction in what they are saying. He is aware and ashamed of his dislike for them. He is a Tory through and through, as his father was before him. It is the logical, the patriotic, the honest choice. He has never until this moment felt in any means awkward about it. At the far end of the room, a crowd has gathered around another pair of double doors, and as he watches, this crowd loosens and pulls back a step or two as a couple emerge, pink-faced and giddy.
"What is it like?"
he hears the waiting people cry. But the gabble of the couple is inaudible at this distance. He only hears the girl's breathless giggle and sees her raise her fists to either side of her face in mimicry of the mermaid's rigour. Some of the young men and women try to peep through the gap in the door.
"Oh, ho, no, you must wait your turn."
And in goes a trio of girls with their arms knotted around one another. Once within, they let up a shrieking and barrel back out at once, clamouring their surprise and horror.
"All these people," says Angelica Neal, "come to see your mermaid. Come on your account."
She drags him through the crowd, breathlessly, chattering over her shoulder.
"The girls are enthralled by it. They relish being so frightened. I believe you must have many extraordinary tales."
Her eyes flick briefly to his mouth before she turns back to the door and raps her fist against it.
"Hurry up in there! We are more important than you!"
She turns her back to the door so she can look up at him.
"I wonder, does it reassure the men," she says, "the way Belle scorns the situation of women? They can feel easy that she has chose this life herself."
Again, he has nothing to add, save for a meek,
"I dare say."
"I chose it,"
she says softly. She draws closer to him, a warm cloud of starch and flowers and her own ripe skin scent.
"Do you know why?"
He shakes his head.
"Because I am never happier than in a man's embrace. There is no pleasure in the world that I like better."
Their bodies are very close.
She presses her palms flat against the door on either side of her hips, so that she is turned to face him square on. He tries not to gaze upon her bosom, but it is always in his vision as he looks bashfully at her throat, her chin, her lips. It rises pale and soft as she breathes deeply, and the velvet flowers heave. When the doors open behind her, she falls flat on her back. Three young navy men in plush indigo jackets and white breeches are coming out, and when she tumbles nearly straight into them, they cannot disentangle their consternation from their mirth.
"'Pon my soul!'
says one, his black hair all awry, while the others, merry with wine, clutch their sides until tears squeeze from their eyes.
"'Pon my soul, you dizzy maid, what were you about?'
Mr. Hancock stands all dismayed. The collapse of his companion is one thing, but he has always felt wistful at the sight of young men in blue jackets. Since his youth, he cherished the ambition that a son of his would go to the navy, and it might yet be that young Henry carouses now on some foreign shore, a midshipman with ruffled curls, just as these he sees before him. When Mr. Hancock makes no move to help her, the dark-haired lieutenant reaches down to take Angelica's hand.
"'Do not trouble yourself!'
she snaps, ruffled as a cat who has fallen off a fence.
"'Forgive me!'
says Mr. Hancock, leaping belatedly to her assistance. But what with her great heavy skirts and her stays which prevent the necessary bending, she flounders there and rises not at all. The men stand in a semicircle, watching, one giggling helplessly, while she slumps on the floor, the merchant heaving on her arm with much perspiration. After some minutes of this, the lieutenant steps in again.
"'You must permit me!'
And he taking one of Angelica's arms and Mr. Hancock the other, they hoist her to her feet in a moment.
"'She is launched!'
cries one of the men.
"'I'll drink to that!'
says another. And they rollick away with a great huzzah.
"'Are you hurt?'
says Mr. Hancock. But Angelica, shaking out her skirts and fluffing out her hair, is only rageful.
"'Close the door, for pity's sake!'
she snaps.
"'Do not make me any more of a spectacle!'
"'Am I to stay?'
he ventures. But she is too busy patting herself down to answer, grumbling.
And who invited them, after all, such horrid tars? This vulgar sort of revelry would never have been tolerated in this establishment 10 years back. The company is not what it was.
And at this moment she shoots him a look of such particular venom that he supposes he ought to leave her alone. Then again, he is afraid to be out in that thronged room, unescorted. Choosing to take his chances on a ruffled woman over a supercilious crowd, he shuts the door, bolts it for good measure, and they are alone in the mermaid's grotto. In fact, it is very well done. Mrs. Chapel has somehow contrived to bring in an array of great glass fish tanks with gilt chasing, full of green water and pearly fish. There are green and blue shades on all the candles, so what little light there is has a queer underwater coolness to it, and the walls are swagged and draped with raw silk and strings of pearls. The mermaid itself is raised up on a plinth, surrounded by branches of red and white coral, and the flickering candlelight gives the impression of movement, as if the coral were fluttering and the infant mermaid squirming. Somewhere in the room, a little fountain is splashing. And then there is the singing. He sees no girls in the room, but their voices weave around him in a high, wordless melody, as if all the sirens had banded together to lure him to their shores. The noises of the party without melt into oblivion.
"Oh,"
says Angelica. She has composed herself, and her eyes are upon the crooked little mermaid.
"So this is what they look like."
In the shifting light, she is soft around the edges. When she becomes aware of his gaze, She smiles as if she has never been put out in the first place.
"Do you like it?"
she asks.
"I do,"
he says, and she advances upon him across the room, her silks sighing.
"Come,"
she says.
"I wish to look more closely."
And taking his hand, leads him to stand before the creature. Although he affects a face of grave study, he has looked upon the mermaid far too many times to apprehend anything new about it, and his eyes rest upon it without seeing it at all. He cannot think, with her so close to him, and leaning in ever closer, of anything besides her. Every single nerve in his fingers aches and sings as she caresses them. She is so close that her arm presses against his, and the warmth of her body, the suggestion of her skin, is a shock to him. The invisible singing rises gently, and he thinks, "This is not the music of mermaids, but of angels." She puts her face up to his, very serious, so pretty that he wishes to press his lips to the little crease between her brows. But he does not move. Her lips are just parted. Her eyes seek his. With her body so near to him, he already feels he is about to die. But then she makes a little wiggle, and her stays slip down her bosom. Either she is very expert in what she does, or there is an ingenuity to her clothes that is lacking in other women's, for she does it in a single swift movement, and all the while looking perfectly at him. She only exposes another inch of herself, but her breasts strain against the band of chenille flowers, and the smell of vanilla and roses rises into the room, along with another smell. What he thinks must be that of her own body, something like that sharp and flowery scent that rises off the skin of orchard fruit, plums or peaches, a sun-warmed fragrance, a kind of promise. There is no slackness to what he sees of her breasts. They are full and pale, seamed with one or two pearly lines, quivering just fractionally in time with her pulse.
"Here,"
she whispers, and lifting his hand, places it squarely upon her bosom. For a moment, his bare skin upon hers, he is lost. Her breasts are pressed together by her stays, faintly damp with her sweat, and they yield with a little spring to his fingertips. If he were bolder, he would run hands over them and press and squeeze and fill his palms with them, but he is quite simply petrified. He stands stock still, as if a small boy caught in the act of misdemeanor, but he cannot remove his hand from her body. She is as soft as... well, what is there to compare it to? She is not soft like velvet or silk, nor like lamb's wool. She is soft as human flesh, that is all. Fair, warm skin, blanketed over a veil of womanly fat. And somewhere deep underneath it all are her tendons and muscles, her hot blood, her pumping heart.
"My soul,"
he whispers. And there is a little falter in the singing, comparable to a giggle. In the swimming green light, she looks up into his face with a peculiar expression, mischief or adoration.
"What I wish you to do to me,"
she whispers, and it is all he can do to control himself. They press together a little longer. Her hair drifts around both their faces in the upgust from the candles. The mermaid hunches darkly under its glass dome, but neither one of them is thinking of it.
"But the night is very young,"
Angelica is murmuring, interspersing her words with little wet kisses on his lips and his face. Her kisses are firm and delicate, like her mouth. He can feel the particular arch of her upper lip even as she presses it against him.
"We have already spent too long locked up together, when others are hammering to take their place in here."
She takes his hand again.
"Will you rejoin the party with me?"
He wants to pull her back to him. He puts his hands on her waist and cannot help then but to run them down her back and over her hips, up to her breasts. There is something compelling about the shape of her body, its symmetry, its dimensions, the very glide of her, that he thinks he could spend all day touching and never tire of. "Come along," she says again, tugging him towards her. He is hard as a yardstick.
"May I not?" he asks. "Here, where it is private, I could be quick."
"I dare say you could."
And there is a little flicker of he knows not what in her eyes. Perhaps he has misspoke, but he has always had the impression they are grateful when a gentleman is quick. She pulls away, as if it is easy for her.
"Outside, there is a party all for your sake. Mrs. Chapel has laid on many splendid things that you have not yet seen, and I wish to dance."
She is unbolting the door, but before she throws it wide, she looks up at him one more time with those wide eyes of hers, and says,
"When you take your pleasure with me, sir, I mean to take my time about it."
He sees a flash of white teeth upon her lower lip. Then she is all sunny mischief.
"Come," she says. "The entertainment begins."
Chapter 14. The first thing he notices as they return to the great chamber is that every member of the little orchestra has turned his face to the wall. They play on with their backs to the proceedings, their chins lowered, and even their leader has his toes a mere inch from the skirting, so that when he becomes too inspired in his conducting, he raps his knuckles against the panelling.
"What is afoot?"
asks Mr. Hancock, his hand in Angelica's. All the party have moved off the floor, standing three or four men deep in a circle. Some lounge on couches, some even having their hair and lapels fondled by girls, but even they are strangely watchful, craning their necks to regard the room.
"The entertainment is about to begin," says Angelica, and at that moment there is a little rustling of excitement, and Mrs. Chapel, strident as a schoolmistress, announces, "A dance! The Sirens and the Sailors!"
The footmen open the doors wide, and first there enter eight boisterous young men, naked to the waist, wearing neckerchiefs and white broadcloth trousers that flap above their ankles. As the orchestra strikes up, they execute a swift hornpipe, their neckerchiefs flying and their feet stamping. A little shine of sweat breaks out in the hollows of their backs, and above the stamping can be heard the careful rhythm of their breathing. They have scrubbed young faces, their jaws barely fuzzed, and their bodies are smooth and hairless.
"Those boys never went to sea,"
scoffs Mr. Hancock as the crowd applauds, but Angelica nudges him in the ribs. The boys are still for a moment, their feet wide apart and their chests rising and falling in the glister of the chandeliers. Now the doors are opened again, and the sound of high, liquid female singing floods the room. The crowd murmurs. The room seems to Mr. Hancock to rise a degree or two in temperature, and is suddenly filled with eyes, all the men blinking and peering about, looking sharply here and there for what is coming. The light sits in many tiny stars on their moist lower lids. Thus enter, singing, eight beautiful girls, the finest from Mrs. Chapel's stables. Each holds a comb and a mirror, her hair falling over her shoulders and back, and each is as good as naked. They wear seed pearls around their necks, and their hair is sprigged with coral and laced with ropes of pearls, but they make no attempt to cover their breasts or their bellies. Skeins of sea-green chiffon hang from their wrists and float behind them, and around their waists they wear ingenious girdles of mother-of-pearl, a very many crescents strung together to suggest a row of scales, shimmering and clinking as the mermaids move their hips. A few slivers fall down fore and aft, rather in coyness than in true modesty, for he sees, clear as day, that all the hair upon their mounds of pleasure has, by some cunningness, been turned as green as the moss that fringes a seaside rock pool.
"Oh, they are well done," cries Angelica, breaking out into applause.
"If they set out to give themselves arsenic poisoning," says Mr. Hancock, but not so that it may be heard by anybody but himself. More loudly, he adds, "I never saw such a thing," which is more diplomatic but no less sincere, for indeed he is nearly as astounded by these mermaids as he was by his own genuine article. He is also as little delighted. He recognizes among the girls those he has seen before, the dusky one from downstairs, her nipples dark as raisins, her eyes closed as she begins a languid dance. And it does not feel quite easy to be looking upon those little misses, whom he still half thinks of as errant housemaids or runaway daughters. He sees that their bodies are beautiful, but he feels nothing but avuncular concern. To lay hand on such a child at his age seems both unseemly and distasteful. "And yet, who am I to say?" he reprimands himself. "I do not make the tastes. That is for the great men in the room." The girls form themselves into a line, facing at 2 yards distance the line of sailors, and as the musicians play on, they sing a new song. "Now the seduction begins," whispers Angelica, and truly as the girls sing and beckon, the sailors begin slowly to advance upon them. The girls are coquettish behind their mirrors, stretching thick locks of their hair out from their heads with the combs, and letting the curls fall back over their shoulders all in perfect unison. It is at this moment that Mr. Hancock perceives that the sailors' enthusiasm for the sirens is not an act. In each of their broadcloth trousers there is an unmistakable heaving, which only grows more noticeable with each flick of the girl's hair, each lovely sway of their naked hips. "What is happening?" he asks sharply. The mood in the room, that watchful eagerness he noticed even before the girl's entrance, has not dissipated. In fact, it is building. The men are more alert than ever, and there is a steam of sweat amongst them, a strange tight breathlessness. Somebody lets out a small groan. The girls are dancing like true river nymphs from an ancient fresco, their bosoms quivering upon their ribcages, sliding and yielding with their stretching muscles. And every man but Mr. Hancock has his hand in his breeches. "What is this?" he whispers. The man at his side is engaged in noisy, wet kissing with one of the young ladies, and she is fumbling urgently at his belt buckle. The others watch the dance with terrible keenness, their wrists working vigorously as the mermaids wilt into the arms of the sailors. And as the 8 sailors' hands slide up the flanks of their 8 mermaids in perfect unison, and 8 bright nipples are rolled between 8 sets of finger and thumb, these old men begin to disrobe themselves, shaking off their jackets and loosening their cravats. The mermaids seem almost to swim against their lovers, their bodies nudging and undulating in a way that is so perfectly, strictly dance-like, but which is not a dance any longer. The sailor, partnered with the mulatto girl, is the first to unbuckle his trousers, but the other 7 follow in quick, choreographed succession. "I think they do not mean to stop," says Mr. Hancock. Angelica is watching intently and critically, like a woman at a new play. "Stop," she says. "Why, no. They're only just begun." Everywhere around the room, just at waist height, is a flutter with movement. Men pleasure themselves as if in private, with their shirts falling open over their hairy bellies. Mr. Hancock knows now how best each of 11 members of Parliament likes to be touched. Some stand to watch the proceedings unfold. Others have already retreated to couches, loosing the tapes of their ladies' white gowns so they fall away from their bodies like sea foam, and these lovely nymphs knead and flatter their flaccid lovers into enthusiasm. The sailors drop their trousers. Their bowsprits are extended.
"Sheath up," booms Mrs. Chapel. "If you did not purchase protection on the way in, you must avail yourself of it now. If I see any man going into the breach without armour, you may be sure he will never make another sally."
A maid, artfully draped, scuttles in with a vast marble dish of milk, in which the condoms have been soaked to perfect tenderness. Mrs. Chapel shakes one dry and holds it aloft for the crowd to see.
"No excuses!"
The sailors grasp the mermaid's hips, the assembled worthies in the front row bring out their members to air, and Mr. Hancock blunders for the door. He pushes through the men, crouched and lewd as baboons, without looking at them. He is even more anxious not to touch them, and he struggles through with his arms raised up to guard his face, using his forearms and elbows to force his path. Angelica is pursuing him.
"Where are you going?"
she asks, when she catches him up on the landing. He is sucking in deep breaths of air as a swimmer surfacing.
"I'm leaving," he says.
"Will you not?"
She places a hand on his arm.
"Why not stay?"
She is all honey and cherries.
"If this is not to your taste, we can take ourselves off. There are private rooms upstairs,"
she adds in a sugared murmur.
"No, no, no!"
He has no appetite for her now. Everything about her is sullied, her beauty too effusive, all there for anybody to look upon. Nothing about her is secret or private. He sees that she is a bauble for old men's pleasure, nothing more. Her mouth is crestfallen, and the little crease has taken up its place between her brows, but he cannot trouble himself with her expressions.
"I've made a mistake,"
he says briefly.
"Come," she coaxes in a high, soft voice. "Come sit down with me."
"This is not a place for a man of my sort."
"Come, have a glass of something nice."
"I must away."
Before she can entreat him any further, he pulls his arm from her grasp and takes to the stairs. She watches him from the banister as the footmen fetch him his hat and greatcoat. She leans over.
"My dear heart," she calls,
but he does not so much as look up. The only answer she receives is the hurried clatter of his footsteps on the marble as the top of his head passes beneath her and out of the door. Chapter 15. It may very well be that Angelica believes what she has said, that she finds no greater pleasure than in the arms of men. However, her believing it does not make it true. Angelica has endured many encounters that were not to her liking, some too brief, some too extended, some brutal, some tentative, some bizarre, some tedious. She has given pleasure to men made noisome by foul and boozy breath or fetid underarms or gallons of rancid eau de cologne, and she has indulged them to spend themselves all over, variously, her bosom, her belly, her feet, her bedsheets, her hair, and the small of her back, as well as inside nearly any orifice that pleases them. She has donned an admiral's tricorne, affected schoolgirl innocence, and she has nipped down the back stairs in her dishabille in search of a likely switch or whisk or carpet beater when an evening demanded particular aggression of her. She has suffered deviants whose skill did not match their pride to work at her privates with their lips and tongues, and, God save her, their teeth, for hours at a time, and she has applied her own mouth to things she would not independently have chose to. Her career in coitus has not, in short, been a perfect round of pleasure on her part. But mark you, whatever small disappointment or boredom or terror she might experience during the act is more than eclipsed by all the attendant enjoyments of her profession. Whoredom appeals to Angelica's character in a great host of ways. She likes to live closely with other women and share her secrets with them. She likes to sing and drink and dance. She likes to be cosseted. She likes to be looked at. What she likes best of all is to be desired. It tickles her to see men grown stupid when they gaze upon her, all soft-eyed and slow in the head. In fact, it inflames her to find that her eyes and body and manner drive them out of their wits, to feel the humidity of their palms when they remove their gloves, or watch the involuntary twitch of their members when she moves close towards them. To discover that secret other world of commerce in which she is at least as powerful as they, all of this provokes in her the most exquisite excitement, and she goads them into ever greater passions of fever and fury. She likes to be pursued, but she does not feel she is ever captured, for it is only by her own decision that they lay hands on her. And so she is perturbed. This eventuality had not occurred to her. She had no other plan for the evening, for how could this one go awry?
"And he, a wretched merchant," she thinks as she flounces back into the great and now orgiastic chamber. "I should have had him in an instant. He has no idea what he's given up, for in no other circumstances in the world will he ever be near me again." What should she do now? The shine has been taken off the proceedings, although there are a great many men here who might be ripe for cultivation, she having been dangled before them for 3 years, docile in the corner of the Duke's country parlour with lace veiling her bosom and her hair unadorned. What red-blooded man does not desire his friend's mistress, after all? And what enterprising man does not step into the breach once this friend is no longer able to defend her? Now would be her moment to step back into the firmament, to flirt and charm and negotiate, for amongst these men who watched her for so long, there must be a likely protector. But she finds the will is no longer in her. What so repelled Hancock that he could walk away so easily? Was it merely the scene? Or was the fault in me? Is there something wanting in my manner or my countenance? Am I too old? And she keeps to the shadows and only smiles when hallooed by priapic admirers. She happens idly to think of the dark-haired naval officer, young, handsome, perhaps impressionable. Certainly the look that passed between them when he helped her up was not an ordinary one. There was no mistaking it. A communication passed between them at that moment, part greeting and part question. He must have felt it too. But no, no, she will not look for him. If a paunchy cit has no time for her allures, a young rake must certainly laugh in her face. She traipses instead to the private chambers upstairs, where the housemaids burst from the jib door with armfuls of linen, and Mrs. Chapel hustles them about with breathless discretion. "And the blue room? Occupied too? Well then, there's nothing for it, nothing for it. You'll have to throw my own chamber, opened to use." Polly, her fish scales rattling, her green dye smeared, is dancing on the spot with anxiety. "And where am I to take the Admiral?" she demands. "If she," a glare at the equally smeared Eleanor, "removes to your chamber."
"Christ! We are full to the gunnels."
Mrs. Chapel presses her fists against her eyes for a moment, and then smooths down her gauzy apron with calm decision.
"Very well. Lucy and Clorinda, you will have to make up the servants' rooms for entertaining. The bedsprings are wanting and the stairs are steep, so do not take old men there, for once up there, there'll be no getting them down again."
"If only it were so,"
snorts one of the girls, but Mrs. Chapel waves her quip away as she rattles on.
"Then bring the couch from my room onto the landing. That will serve for another meeting place. As for you," she turns to Angelica, "if you come in search of a bed, Mr. Hancock must be disappointed for the time being. There is not a corner of this house that is not given over to vice."
"You need fear nothing from me."
"Then what are you doing up here, under my feet? Is anything amiss? Are you keeping the gentleman amused?"
"Oh, yes, yes, of course."
"Because he must want for nothing," I shan't have you abandoning him, miss. This is his party, and I wish him pleased. We need our mermaid.
He is mightily satisfied.
Mrs. Chapel narrows her eyes.
Where is he?
Angelica hesitates, but at this very moment the girls stagger out with the couch, and in their blind exertion topple a Japanese screen. The air is rent with a terrible crack, and one lacquered panel shears in two.
"Coswounds!" exclaims Mrs. Chapel. "What have you done now, you fools?"
The girls are white-faced. One begins immediately to weep.
"Get away!"
Mrs. Chapel snaps to Angelica.
"Whatever you wandered here for, I do not have the time for it. Make yourself useful. Call them all to dinner. The old men have exerted themselves enough, I dare say. They're only cluttering the place up now in the hope of being fed. We may yet send them home by midnight."
"And then the real party may begin,"
says Eleanor cheerfully, for she is parched for a glass of something strong and may not indulge until her duties are done. Casting one more glance around for the naval officer, Angelica trots back down the stairs and strikes the Chinese gong on the first floor landing.
"Refreshments!"
she announces to the great chamber, where some are straightening their garments and blinking about themselves.
"Downstairs, at your pleasure."
A long table has been magicked into the vast ground floor atrium, laid for 50 and spread with pies and tarts, roast fowl and jellies and ices. Mrs. Fortescue alone is already seated. Her plate is empty, but she has filled her glass generously.
"Ah,"
says Angelica, taking a seat beside her as the guests drift down in various gradations of nakedness.
"The ghost at the feast."
Belle's eyes move heavily over the scene.
"What happened to the mermaid man?"
she asks.
"Gone."
There is a fortuitous tower of sweetmeats on the table, and Angelica pops one into her mouth. Its sugary crunch gives way to gushing syrup. She takes another and licks her fingers.
"He did not appreciate the lewdness,"
she adds, her aplomb some way restored.
"No surprise?" "I am sure I do not care."
Angelica speaks indistinctly, for her tongue is engaged in peeling the slick paste of a marron glacé from the roof of her mouth.
"I can do better than a stuffy old shopkeeper in a singed wig."
She swallows.
"And I mean to, tonight."
Belle Fortescue is grave, even in her gossip.
"Has someone caught your eye?"
she whispers.
"Point him out."
Up go their fans. Thus screened, they survey the room.
"By the piano,"
says Angelica, smiling so that from a distance she might appear to be exchanging some pleasantry.
"The navy man with the dark hair." "Talking to Mr. Winstanley?"
says Mrs. Fortescue, looking amiably in the other direction.
"I know that man."
Angelica is possessed by a little gust of excitement, but Mrs. Fortescue straightens out her face and shakes her head infinitesimally.
"No,"
she says.
"No money." "Well, that don't signify. I deserve some fun."
"You are greedy and you have no self-control," Mrs. Fortescue admonishes her, "always snatching at the fattest bun on the plate. Dear, your situation..."
"Oh, my situation, always my situation, and I must exercise good judgment, try to make prudent decisions for my future preservation. You sound just like Eliza, do you know that?"
Her eyes are on the sweets again, seeking out a pretty lavender comfit. Her saliva is already running in anticipation, to feel it crumble and melt softly on her tongue.
"I want some fun, Belle. Do you remember fun? Pleasure, dissipation. I'll not be this young tomorrow."
She glances at the officer.
"What's his name?"
Belle sighs and raises her solemn eyes to heaven.
"Rockingham. George Rockingham." "Oh, a good family.
Much good as it does him, he is of a very sickly branch of it. I know his uncle, who is his guardian, and I assure you he is kept on a very straitened allowance, and he has no access to the rest of his fortune until he's 25. She leans to whisper in her friend's ear,
"He's younger than you."
"Better than older," snorts Angelica. "I have not enjoyed a man of real vigour for far too long." Seizing the opportunity of their intimacy in such a crowd, she says,
"Belle, will you not miss it?"
"Miss what? Vigour?"
"No, no. Everything. All of this. You're sacrificing a great deal in getting married, I think."
Mrs. Fortescue continues to watch the room. It is hard to tell from her sad, reflective little face what she might really be feeling. She is soulful even when she is rinsing out her stockings.
"I'm quite done here," she says. "I see not how," says Angelica.
But Mrs. Fortescue's words sink to the pit of her stomach like lead. She thinks of the earnest exertions of the little girls and feels very weary.
"Do you not? I look at it all and I think..."
She spreads her hands and widens her eyes as if in appeal. "What a farce! Such empty mummings as I took part in for 10 years and thought myself free."
"You were wrong to make a scene tonight,"
says Angelica. Mrs. Fortescue laughs.
"Why, how can I smile these things away?"
"But you ought. Some of us are happy here."
"Who?"
"Name me one person."
"Oh, 'tis all a glamour to you."
Angelica knows when to end a conversation.
"I am as free as I would like to be, and freer than any wife."
"Of course you are."
"I am. For now, I depart to make my own free choice of what man to take my pleasure with, something no wife may do."
"Although some have."
"Without consequence? I think not. I am free as a bird."
She rises from her seat, and it topples behind her, for her skirt is large and her sobriety compromised.
"Will there be no consequences for you?"
Belle asks quietly. But her friend is already darting away. Bright with excitement, Angelica glances once back.
"See how I go,"
she says.
Chapter 16. Virtuous people will not know that very particular pleasure two strangers feel when, without touching or speaking, they are agreed that they will end the night together. There is no pursuit for Angelica and her George. They simply find one another. When Angelica bounces over and takes her seat amongst the group, they exchange salutation with their eyes, but have no more to do with one another. She takes her time in clasping the hand of her old friend, Lucy Chadwick, one-time lover of 3 princes of the realm, and honouring a few of the younger navy men with some light flirtation. Rockingham is similarly engaged with young Billingsgate Kitty, who will shortly be led away to her chaste bed, being not ripe enough for her own official debauchery, although her time will soon come. He persists in the face of her dutiful muteness with what strikes Angelica as wondrous patience. She detects, she thinks, a glint of humour in his brown eyes, but she does not seek to meet them. There will be time for all this yet. The group have just drawn out a die, an item of contraband, since Mrs. Chapel will have no gambling in her establishment.
"But surely... even she would not object to an innocent game of high jinks,"
urges one of the navy men.
"He who rolls lowest takes a drink."
And as the die is passed from hand to hand around the circle and skitters dizzily across the tabletop, while the players hold their breath or shriek with mirth, Angelica and Rockingham are always aware of one another. When she laughs, his mouth opens in a grin without his bidding it. And when he claps his hands at their sport, she might be observed to be clasping her own together. Put a die in these people's fists,
and of course they will be inclined irresistibly to make bets. They seize up morsels from the half-cleared table.
I wager there's walnuts that Mrs. Chadwick casts lowest. A bunch of cherries on Carter, rolling a four.
They slap their palms on the table and slop liquor into one another's glasses with no regard for whether it matches what was there before. All social gatherings have a riptide moving through them. Some revellers joining the party as others melt away, some retiring to a quiet room, others emerging refreshed. And it is this unseen, unsought tide that nudges Angelica and the lieutenant closer and closer together without their even trying. Little Kitty is swept away, protesting. Lucy Chadwick judges herself to have graced the party with her presence long enough, and besides has two little children snuggled in the Hampstead countryside, who will, in a very few hours, want her at breakfast, and so she makes for her carriage. She is replaced, in short order, by the erstwhile mermaids Eleanor Bewley and Polly Campbell, their hair freshly dressed, and their modesty restored by matching silk wraps, giggling to embark on a night of outrage and intemperance now that Mrs. Chapel is safely abed in clean sheets. Angelica is first five chairs away from Rockingham, then three, until when the clock chimes for a quarter after four, they find themselves side by side in the midst of the depleted group.
"Is it too late?" she says. "To revise your first impression of me?"
His face splits into the most amiable of grins.
"But why? I liked it. A woman never fell at my feet before."
"Be assured I never shall again," she says.
"Rockingham," he says, and he puts her hand briefly to his lips.
"Lieutenant Rockingham,"
she nods, surveying his uniform.
"What, this?"
He laughs, glances down at himself.
"No, I only wore it to come in here. A mermaid party, you know. I was in the Navy once, only they would not tolerate my high spirits."
He rubs his hair roguishly and turns upon her the smile of a cherub.
"I am a student of law, for now."
"Oh, so you shall be a lawyer by and by?"
But he looks at her so quizzically, she fears for a moment that she has slipped, unknowing, into some low provincial dialect, as she was wont to as a girl, to her own mortification and her patron's amusement.
"I should hope I'll never earn my living so. A gentleman wants a profession to keep the mind sharp, that's all, and perhaps to see him into Parliament."
"Ah," she thinks, "Bell was incorrect. Of course he has means. God be praised, for he's so handsome."
She smiles as he goes on.
"One travels, of course, but it wears after a while. Such an endless round of scenery and curios. I was glad to leave Naples by the end, I can tell you. Full only of sightseers, dilettantes, pleasure seekers. Not a one of them with a real appreciation for the place."
"Oh, of course, of course."
Their heads nod closer together until their fascination envelops them. They forget their friends and their old lovers, pains and anxieties, as their worlds telescope into this one space where he is her best friend and she his.
"Mrs. Neal,"
their friends say.
"Angelica, 'tis your turn."
She is not listening. They have to prise her fingers open and press the dye into her palm before she will drag her attention from her dark-haired friend.
"Must I?" "Throw! Throw the dye!" "Very well, very well."
She turns away from the man with reluctance. "For I am yours, really," her manner tells him. But she is pleased for him to see her sportive side. She presses her lips together and closes her eyes as she warms the dye between her hands and flings it down on the table. It leaps once, twice. It stops just short of diving onto the floor and balances on the table's inlaid edge one single dot smiling up at the room. The company howls. The men's wigs are all askew, those that remain on their heads at all. It is strange to see these bloods reduced to tousled boys. Their cropped heads are fascinating, touchable. This one a fuzz as close as a puppy's belly. This one a nest of coppery curls.
Drink,
they call.
Take a drink.
Oh, no, she says. I want no more of it.
She's comfortably drunk. She wishes to tinge her judgment no further, but her companions have no mercy.
Rules are rules. Drink!
What was the game?
She turns appealingly to Rockingham.
High jinks,
roar her friends,
and you could roll no lower. Drink! Drink!
She utters an unwilling bleat.
I cannot. Do not make me.
Drink!
Rockingham, though not a lieutenant at all, remains gallantry personified. He puts a hand boldly upon her elbow and says,
If the lady does not want a drink, she should not be obliged to take one.
His comrades boo, and she wafts her fan, for her face has become suddenly hot. The lieutenant lets go of her elbow.
Rules are rules, he continues, and we all agree that she who will not drink must pay a forfeit.
A forfeit?
She gasps and swats at him, which act of daring makes her giddy.
What have you got me into?
What's it to be, boys? Ladies?
Eleanor Bewley and Polly Campbell are whispering together and squawk with joy.
I know,
says Eleanor.
She's to play mermaid.
I beg your pardon?
If we can do it, so can you, says Polly.
Her fingertips are still stained green.
You must go outside.
Into the garden,
chimes in Eleanor.
Down to the fountain. And swim 3 times all the way around it.
Naked, says Polly, with satisfaction.
Quite naked.
I shan't,
says Angelica.
I can't. The fountain is barely 2 feet deep.
Mermaid,
the girls set up chanting.
Mermaid, mermaid.
'Tis October,
protests Angelica, but they are up from the table and she is running with them, laughing now.
You are absurd. I shall keep my chemise on. Mermaids do not wear chemises,
says Polly as they burst out into the dark garden. The men are behind them, calling for lanterns. Only Rockingham accompanies them, for he can be nowhere but at Angelica's side.
Well, I am not a mermaid, says Angelica. I'll go in the water, but I'll not strip down to nothing.
In other circumstances, she would have no such qualms. She loves to go naked before an admiring party. In her career, she has danced on tables and rolled on petal-strewn couches, wearing not even so much as a pair of garters. But now, she hesitates. She does and does not wish to be naked before this man. Letting him glimpse her body in a moment during which he may not touch it or betray himself is tempting to her. But she had hoped to savour this unknowing a little longer. Tonight she would have flirted for hours more and coaxed him into a dark corner to kiss her until they both trembled. She would have let him touch her first over her chemise in the warm dark of her bedchamber, and then undress her, or not, as his passions dictated. It would take them a long time to discover one another. If he looks upon her now, half the fun is gone before they have begun.
I think I shall not do it,
she announces. He hands her a bottle of brandy.
Go on, he says. I'll close my eyes.
The men are coming out with torches and lanterns, which dredge the little garden with yellow light. Their voices have a crispness that comes with cloudless nights and bounce off the high walls. It is cool and fresh, but not so cold the feat cannot be done. Angelica takes off her slippers, and then her stockings. The flagstones ice the soles of her feet, but she detects perhaps the last of the sun's warmth aching through.
"'Tis not so bad,' she says. "'Help me, girls!'
And they swarm over her to unpin her bodice and shuck her of skirts and petticoats, which they trample carelessly underfoot as they tug at the knots of the bumroll that girdles her hips. Eleanor holds it aloft, a long satin pudding, and all are convulsed with laughter.
"'Do not lose that,'
Angelica says sternly, as the men toss it between one another, horrified and intrigued.
"'Nor abuse it. I had it made to my own measurements, and there's not another like it. I said there's not another like it. Do not take such liberties. It does not go on your head.'
She has on only her stays over her chemise, and the girls' busy fingers are all over them, loosing their strings, easing them open to shake out the creases from the chemise beneath, the only thing now separating her skin from the air. It falls to just below her knees, its sleeves tight and plain, which makes her look as spotless as any of Mrs. Chapel's newest acquisitions. The girls fumble to denude her of this, too, but she shrieks and slaps their hands away.
"'Into the water with you,' says Captain Carter. "'They have you outnumbered.'
The fountain is 15 feet across, a great shallow basin scalloped like a shell. The water cascades down from an acrobatic dolphin in its centre, churning the black pool up silver in the dark. At the bottom of the pool drift golden fish, dim ghosts in their sleep. Angelica scrambles on to the lip of the basin. Inside, it is dead cold, and slippery with algae to the point of greasiness.
"'Oh, so I'm going in, am I?'
"'Yes!'
Her hair wafts about her, the water spatters her face and arms, and across her bosom, so her nipples tighten as if a stitch had been tugged in them.
"'Tis fearful cold!'
She swings her legs over the edge, and her feet are in the water, and her ankles, and her calves.
"'Ay me!'
she gasps. The marble ledge numbs her buttocks. Then she slides all the way in. It is cold, 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 cold till her ribcage contracts, and she gasps a quavering, indrawn breath. Leaden cold on her commodity, the warmest part of any woman, and under the cusp of her breasts, and up the insides of her thighs, and gripping cold into her armpits and the crooks of her knees. She raises her hands up.
"'I'm in! Am I not in? I am your very mermaid!'
"'Swim!' shout the party, bottles aloft. "'Three times round!'
And this reminds them of a song, deliciously forbidden to any mariner, which they begin to sing lustily and in all tempos at once.
"'And three times round went our gallant ship, and three times round went she, and three times round went our gallant ship, and she sank to the bottom of the sea, the sea, the sea.'
She feels her very organs are quaking. She cannot swim the shallow pool, but walks it with her hands, grit under her nails and her palms slithering, her stomach grazing the gravel and her chemise floating like the skirts of a jellyfish. The fish are alarmed from their doze and dart about her, their cold bellies bumping her forearms. The falling water thunders about her and strikes her shoulders hard as pebbles, dragging her hair from its powder and pins. Her teeth begin to chatter, but she circles again and rolls over onto her back, singing to the best of her quaking lungs' abilities.
"'We there did spy a fair pretty maid "'with a comb and a glass in her hand, her hand, her hand.'
Then,
"'Where is my comb?'
she demands, "'leaning over the rim of her great scallop shell.
"'Where's my looking-glass?'
"'But by now she is fairly keening with the cold.'
"'Oh, I can take no more. Was it not bravely done?'
She reaches out for her handmaidens, but they recoil.
"'My silk!'
cries Polly, pulling her splendid wrap about her. "'Twill stain, 'twill quite ruin. "'There'll be the devil to pay,' says Eleanor. "'You know how it is. "'I know, I know. "'You turn over 300 a year, "'and you do not own the gowns on your backs,' groans